All right, it is 11 minutes after 9 o'clock, and you've got it on KHUM. Our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign continues this week, dealing with the overarching topic of sexualized violence in Humboldt County. We've had some amazing discussions thus far, and joining us this morning via telephone all the way from Indiana is Jessica Pettit, who's on the road. Good morning, Jessica.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing just fine. Good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, too. The last time, I live in Eureka, but the last time we talked, I was at an airport, and now I am in Indiana. I'm noting a pattern.
You are. Well, you were on the road quite a lot. I mean, it goes with the territory, being a diversity trainer who goes all over the country, lecturing all over the place.
True. There's lots of job security.
Fantastic. Now, today we are taking a look at, I guess, the queer community. I mentioned earlier, I was saying LGBT. I says you also say LGBTQQAI. But I always feel like I'm leaving somebody out.
It's the danger of kind of the string of letters is that you are likely to leave someone out, and also by using the string of letters, it also can be complicated. Like, what's the order that you're supposed to say them? Which one are you leaving in? Which one are you not leaving in? So I use the word queer. Excuse me. I use the word queer as an umbrella term for everyone not heterosexual.
And that works. And you know, the interesting thing about that, and that's sort of been a take back, is that used to be a derogatory term back when I was younger.
And still is in a lot of areas in the country. So then gay is used as a more affirming umbrella term. Mm-hmm. But in other parts of the country is derogatory because it generally only refers to men. So this is the fluidity of language. And it's interesting, even though we're talking about sexualized violence, that language and the use of language in itself can be a form of at least a microaggression of representing or not representing groups. So the idea is just to have a conversation about the language you're using, so which you do a great job of.
Thank you very much. We do our best. So, so we try to be inclusive, and so we will, I guess, for conversation purposes, we will just say the queer community then.
Cool. I haven't checked Facebook in 5 minutes, so I don't know if new words have come up. So.
Okay, it works for me. So the thing is that, you know, we're human beings, and human beings are pretty complex animals, and we often don't fit into the black and white terms that a lot of people spell out for how we are, quote-unquote, supposed to be. And therefore, there are a lot of shades of gray on sexuality, on gender, gender fluidity. And, you know, and because of this, the big long string of terms, and there is absolutely nothing wrong with it. This is just different ways of being a human. And unfortunately, a lot of folks, and we mentioned this when we were kind of teeing up this topic, is that members of the queer community are far more vulnerable to violence and sexualized assault than the straight community, unfortunately.
Right. Most of the statistics that show when we talk about bias incidents or hate-targeted acts of violence, the ones that are most likely to result in death have a gender component connected to them. And the gender component is usually more on the feminine spectrum of someone that someone perceives to be a male. So if a male is being perceived as more feminine than they quote-unquote ought to be, they're much more likely to be targeted for violence, and that violence is much more likely to result in death. Next gender piece is when someone is perceived to be a female and appears to be more masculine than someone else would expect them to be. Gender is a significant marker around what the likelihood of being targeted and then the severity of the violence that they experience.
Here's one thing I don't understand. I can understand that someone who's led a sequestered life, perhaps, and doesn't really understand the fluidity of human beings, and being maybe confused by that. But to be aroused to a point of such violence that one would kill, I don't understand what why that would happen.
Well, I don't necessarily know that I know why it happens, but I think that from my perspective, the patterns that I see is more, it actually goes back to sexualized violence in itself. So some of the reasonings that people come up with is, one of the phrases I like to use is hurt people. So until we break the cycle and chain of violence, people who have been perpetrated or victims or survivors of some kind of violent situation are more likely to then perpetuate violence forward. So that's a piece. I think that there's also some misnomers of how to be masculine or how to be feminine. And those, when you're talking about black and white expectations, I think that there's socially a very limited way that most people feel you're supposed to be masculine or you're supposed to be feminine. And when you see someone who is outside of those expectations to kind of descend your limited or structured definition of either, you then feel entitled to become violent, either to possibly teach the other person a lesson, I'm using air quotes that do not translate over radio, or to then kind of reestablish yourself inside your own black and white, very structured definition of your of femininity. So like often when we talk about gender or violence, bathrooms come up a lot. And what's interesting is that men are usually targeted as the most violent people. And I'm not interested in setting up a competition of who is the most violent. I think violence is violence. But when a female is using a women's restroom, and like let's say a trans person goes into the women's restroom, if that woman, who's the first woman using the bathroom, doesn't validate the second person as a woman in the women's bathroom, they are often very violent, or they call the police, who are then also very violent in that particular situation. So it's around like affirming womanhood or femininity or policing who's allowed to use a woman's space. That also happens.
And now I understand that there can be like misunderstanding, because a woman certainly would not want to have a man following her into a restroom. That could be a potential assault right there. But having a trans person coming into a restroom, very different from having a masculine man walking into a restroom.
Right. So the term for someone who doesn't identify as trans would be cis, C-I-S, or cisgender. It's a privilege that I have, and that I was identified as a woman. I am a woman. I am not a trans person.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting is how we police cisgender is what then stimulate, or how we police gender in general is how we then kind of invite sexualized violence into these gendered spaces as to who is allowed to be there and who is not allowed to be there. And a lot of that ties directly to our kind of internalized sexism or the externalized sexism that a man is a predator. And so someone that I perceive to be overly masculine in a woman's space must have ill intent. And that's related to our ideals of what masculinity and femininity are that need to be really rethought. Masculinity and femininity are really complicated, and there's a lot of ways of doing that. And I think that we should be able to freely express ourselves as we wish in a way that is not violent or inspiring violence.
Speaking of what you do, diversity training, have you dealt with, I know you like do a lot of lecturing on various different campuses. Have you done any of this training with maybe certain police departments on how to deal with certain situations?
I haven't worked directly with a lot of different police departments, at least not in person, but mm-hmm. there are a lot of people who do that kind of training.
Seems like it'd be a good idea.
Yeah, I've reached out specifically to the sheriff and police departments in our county and have invited them to some of the local trainings that I've done, or when advocating for queer people in our community, which is inclusive of trans people as well as not heterosexual people. Sometimes trans people can be straight. That's important to me. Mm-hmm. But when I've been advocating for those folks through the police system or sheriff system, I have done some education kind of in the spot of like what is happening. And I think that there needs to be more of that. We've also done it with, done education within the homeless shelters in the county that's gone really well, as well as both hospitals. Because people just don't understand, and they don't understand how structured their concept of masculinity, femininity, male, female is. And then through that misunderstanding can be something as a microaggression of feeling silenced or marginalized or judged or ignored to significantly larger violent situations that can be life-changing, if not life-ending.
Now, of course, people who are uncomfortable with the queer community versus people who act violent towards the queer community are different, or can be. One thing that I have noticed, and I'm curious to hear what how things are in your perspective, since you are obviously a lot more in touch with all of the information than I am. The question I would have is that over the years, in most recent years, there seems to be a much larger generalized acceptance of the queer community by the mass general population than there has been in a long, long time, as evidenced by a lot of the new same-sex marriage laws that are going in effect all over the country, and restrictive laws that are being overturned, and just changing attitudes in general. Has that translated into less violence, or are the people who perpetrate violence not persuaded by the tide that is changing?
Yeah, great question. And the really annoying answer is both. And what I mean by that is that the patterns, I was just talking about this last night. I'm at Purdue University right now. Mm-hmm. So at my workshops last night, we were just talking about this. And the pattern that I see is that I think that let's go with the first assumption that there is more acceptance.
Right.
And I say that because some people really still do not feel accepted. So it's really hard to tell them, yes, but there's so much more acceptance than there used to be. In their individual life, there still isn't. So it's hard to see that.
Mm-hmm.
So with the first assumption that there is more acceptance, the people who are more likely to be accepting are less likely to have ever been very, very, very unaccepting. Right? So like the quote-unquote converted people, I'm using air quotes again, are more likely to be in the middle, or being accepting doesn't always mean accepting. It means not accepting.
Got
right?
It.
Like there's the middle ground. So the people who are more likely to still be not accepting are more likely to be very, 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 very not accepting. So those are the harder people to get to change their mind. And of course, that can happen, and it does happen, and there's evidence that that is happening, but that does not necessarily mean that it's not still a huge problem. In the groups that I work with, I meet people every day who say they have never met a queer person in their entire life.
Wow.
So then, you know, I walk up to them and shake their hand. Hi, how are you? You have now met one. Right? So, but I also meet people who say they've never seen a person who is not white in their entire life. And they often say this in a room with people in the room who are not white. So the focus isn't on the communities of color in that community. What the focus is on is you're not seeing who is in your community, right? So that is alive and well. So then the people who have not, quote-unquote, come around, probably also feel more threatened and outnumbered. So I think that can make people a little bit more excited, scared, defensive, etc. And that goes either way. So you can also go into communities where there's not a lot of people who feel supported to be queer or trans or an ally. They don't feel like they have a very active community. They're more likely to also be very defensive and very visible, right? So, so I think it's important to mention too that sometimes the quote unquote good side also can turn to violence against the quote unquote bad side. But violence isn't the answer.
No.
And specifically, violence around gender and sexuality is absolutely not the answer.
I have an interesting question with regard to acceptance. Since this, we're talking about human beings as such a broad spectrum, and that acronym getting larger and larger. Is there? I'm just curious. Is there, you know, more of an acceptance of more understood queerness, such as, you know, a gay man or a lesbian woman, rather than someone who is maybe gender fluid or someone who is trans?
Right. And I think that is a really powerful question and also gets to privileges within the quote-unquote gay and lesbian community.
Mm-hmm.
So as we say, I mean, let's take our local community, for example. So if I say gay or lesbian, an image comes to mind, and in unhumbled individual people come to mind, right? Like, oh, I know that person, or I know that person, or as I've been meeting new people, they're like, oh, do you know this person? I'm very involved in the gay community. So what ends up happening is that there's a certain set of dominant identities that have to be in place for that person to be like a key person connected to the gay community. So they're, within the gay and lesbian community, they're very educated, usually upper class, white, cisgender men, and white cisgender women for the gay and lesbian kind of entryway. And what we find is, like, when marriage and adoption and military service are some of the main pieces that we hear about now within the gay agenda, whatever that means, like it's a document I get to download every Monday or something, but if those are the three pieces that are really being focused on, it's important to mention that that's not healthcare or housing or food or employment, because the people who have the voice and the visibility to kind of be setting that agenda have their basics covered. Now we're looking for other places. So it's the work that I do is within those really privileged communities of reminding them that they these kind of dominant gay and lesbian community members, they also can perpetuate violence to people who are a different economic class, different race, different ability issues within our own community. And so that's an important piece to understand, and that, yes, it is exciting that there's some acceptance of kind of this like upper echelon stereotype of a gay or lesbian community, but it's also important to simultaneously remember that those communities, my communities, are very, very diverse, and that there's a wide spectrum of who within Humboldt County actually is within a gay or lesbian or trans or bisexual or pansexual or omnisexual, intersex, queer, questioning, asexual groups, that there's many, many, many other identities that come up. So that's why homelessness or underemployment or mental health issues or healthcare access are also pieces that we really need to be talking about.
Absolutely.
And when we're talking about violence, those are the folks that are far more likely to be targeted by violence than the gay and lesbian folks within our community who have all of these other privileges.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing is... Yeah, it's great. So, the thing that also needs to be mentioned as well, and because I did mention that, you know, that attitudes have been shifting, certain tides have been changing. It's not to say that there is absolute acceptance. It's like with racism, just straight up racism. I mean, is racism better than it was when I was growing up in the 60s? Yeah, it's a lot better.
For some.
Is there still racism? Hell yeah, there is. Lots of it. I mean, so it's like, yes, there have been changes. There's miles and miles and miles to go with that. You know, same with, you know, the queer community. There may have been some changes. And perhaps only affecting, a few, but, there is miles and miles and miles to go.
Sure. And, I mean, referencing some of your future, or not future, past interviews that you've done, there's a lot of progress that's been made around women and women's rights. And there's miles and miles to go. There's a lot of progress that's been made around disability issues. And there's miles and miles and miles to go. And religious privileges. And, like, I mean, what's interesting about progress is that there's some kind of dominant privileged idea that progress has some ending place, like a football field, right? Like, whoa, we're across the halfway line. Now we just have to get to the touchdown. But the world is not a football field.
No.
And things are constantly changing, and individuals have individual lived experiences. So if our entire life is a football field, it is important to mention that that game never ends. It's not just one move. It goes back and forth, up and down, with each individual interaction and each lived experience. It's complicated.
Absolutely. Now, I've had conversations with people who do have problems with the queer community. I've asked, I said, you know, I've been trying to get inside, you know, the head of, you know, someone who does have issues. And it's like, what is the main issue? And the thing that I've heard several times from several different people, it goes against nature. It goes against God's plan. You know, it's a man, it's a woman, it's about breeding, it's about keeping the population going. And I always bring up saying, we seem to have no problem with keeping up our population. You know, I was just listening to a story on NPR this morning on my drive in, where they're doing like forced sterilization of women in India. I mean, this is, we don't seem to be having any problem keeping this population going. Yeah, despite all the different types of sexuality that we have, and a lot of it not leading to procreation, we don't seem to be waning as a species.
Yes, and I think that what that brings up, first off, forced sterilization happens in the United States all the time if you're living below the poverty level. That's an important thing to notice. Number two is that there's this expectation that women produce babies, and that in order to produce babies, we need the drumroll, please, men, to come in and help me produce babies and do my job. So what that does, this is a great opportunity for an ally development, and that is that not all women who identify as heterosexual are capable of producing children, or more importantly, are choosing to produce children. It is also important to mention that heterosexually identified men, not all of them can produce children. So that's one of the big shames that can happen in a woman and a man's life, is if they want to produce children and they can't. And if you're a woman or a man and you're not interested in having children, there's not a lot of room and space for that conversation. So if that's a problem within the heterosexual community, then that can also fuel this kind of argument, so to speak, that a gay or a lesbian person, it goes against nature because they're not having children. Well, bisexual people can also have children. Lesbian people can also have children. Gay people can also have children because of science, right?
And do trans all the time.
People, right. Trans people can also have children because of the way biology works and the way that their physical anatomy works, may or may not be utilized to have children, or they may have had children prior to transition. We have blended families. We have stepchildren who come in. There's adoption. There's foster children. There's legal guardianships. There's shared custody. There's so many complications that actually happen. So it's hard to kind of take that argument really seriously because it's so oppressive to so many people, not just gay and lesbian people.
Absolutely. It's a non-argument. And, you know, the other argument that you hear is a religious one. And, you know, I bring up, you know, first of all, you know, religion has been used as a pretext for violence throughout our history. And it's a terrible thing to use as a weapon, because there are a lot of good people who have, you know, of faith, who would never be violent. But some people do use this as a pretext to violence. And if you're, you know, an argument is that, you know, the Bible says blah, blah, blah. Well, the Bible says lots of things that we as human beings have disregarded because they're immoral. This thing was written a long time ago. A lot of times have changed. And the Bible was written by men. I mean, this is not, you know, handed down as the word of God. And this
who also is usually perceived or put forward as also a man.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, it's, you know, and we had that conversation, you know, a week or so ago about that as well, where that is, you know, just the perception. You know, if you look at, for instance, I was looking at the, you know, the original Hebrew Bible, where God is not mentioned as, there is actually no name, it's just a space holder, and there is no mention of male, female, or anything. This is just the unspeakable. So, you know, it's there's interpretations, and interpretations can be taken in so many different ways, and unfortunately stretched into meanings that can go towards hate.
Yeah, I think what's important and probably shocking to say about this is that I want to support anyone's ability to believe whatever it is that they need to believe, right? And what I think is important to say that is that if someone is holding the belief that family is at the center, that's fine. And there's a lot of different kinds of families.
Yeah,
right? So, like,
this is true.
Why, like, hold your family at your center, and I will totally respect that. And then let me be able to hold my family at my center. I think that we have, and I'm going to blame capitalism because that's how I work, but I think we have this deficit model that's kind of like latently in these conversations, and that if I do my family differently than the way you do your family, that somehow impacts my family. You know, so mm-hmm. let's take it out of identity, at least these identities for a second. But like, I do not have children, full disclosure, you're welcome. But there are people who I've read articles who don't use diapers. Right. So they don't use cloth diapers. They don't use the mass produced diapers. They just raise their children to be able to do whatever they need to do business wise without a diaper and then clean up after that. So there's obviously like class, nanny, time, sanitary implications of this, et cetera. So most of the comments in response to these articles are judging these parents as terrible, horrible parents because they could never do it. Right, but like, if this is how they're parenting and this is how it's working for them, who am I to say that that is bad parenting? That is the same argument of who am I to judge? There's a difference between what is morally appropriate and what is legally appropriate. And because it's legal doesn't mean it's moral, and because it's moral doesn't mean it's legal. But I think that what we need to do, and this goes back to being an ally for any kind of identity, is validating people for their choices and validating people for their identities and how they choose to identify, and just let people rock their own way that they need to be rocked. And that frees up space for me to validate how I identify and validate myself, right? And this is not a deficit model or subtraction of some, you know, energy or something like this. Like, this can all happen at the same time. But in order for that to happen, and this is where my work comes in, we have to be able to listen to each other. We have to be able to have an authentic conversation. And part of that listening is hearing real pain and suffering and lived experiences of violence that actually happen in our community. And if what ends up happening is if you haven't experienced those things, then you're more likely to say like, oh, I don't think that happened. Or you come up with a perfectly logical explanation as to why that happened. Instead of just like, wow, like person X believes and is living through this experience, what would that feel like? Like, how can I be supportive of them living through that experience? Like, that's where the conversations will change. That's where our community will change. But it's hard to do because we tend to be more defensive and fear-based than love-based.
Yep. And unfortunately, we are out of time. It has gone very fast. Jessica, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. I know you've got a pretty busy schedule there in Indiana.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And anything I can do to support you and your programs or anyone in the community, please feel free. I'm around. I'll see you at WinCo.
Great talking to you again. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. That is Jessica Pettit. She is a diversity trainer. She's local, but on the road quite a bit and talking to us from Indiana today. This conversation for Stop the Violence, you will find at our Stop the Violence webpage, which is right there at khum.com. Just click on the Stop the Violence logo. It'll take you right to it. You will have a chance to listen to all the conversations we've had thus far and take a look at where we are going with the campaign. Tomorrow at 8 o'clock, it is our two-hour roundtable discussion dealing with the overarching topic of sexualized violence here in Humboldt County.